Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
It's 7 o'clock here at WBAI in New York 99.5 FM. Time now for Off the Hook.
This is Brunei Telecom. The number you have dialed is incorrect. Please check the number before dialing again. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Off the Hook.
Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this delightful Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Hello.
Out in Skype land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Booming in like a thunderstorm. We have Gila.
Hello.
And I believe we have Alex somewhere in the world.
That's correct. Good evening, everybody. I'm in Slovenia tonight, so hello.
Oh, I was going to guess that. Wow, Slovenia, good. That's pretty cool. Ljubljana, I believe.
No, I'm actually in Porto Rose tonight. So I'm right on the Adriatic Sea, just down the street from Pirano. And next week I'll be in another country, if we're on next week, that is.
Okay, well, that's okay. On assignment. Yeah. Alex over there in Slovenia, looking for maybe some statues to topple over. We'll see. We have not one special guest tonight, not two, but three special guests. I don't think we've ever had three guests other than a pre-Hope show at the same time. But we're going to get to that in just a moment. I wanted to preamble that just a little bit by calling attention to the fact that you can't do anything on the internet these days without being monitored in one way or another. Have you noticed that? I just started to realize that this week. You obviously you buy something, you're tracked. You connect to something, you're tracked. One of your computers connects to another computer someplace, and it's just constantly giving your information out. And it just doesn't feel like it used to feel. You know, way back in the good old days. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight, is something different, something new that's been introduced. In fact, the Register had a great headline about this new project, which is called VEILID. It's spelled V-E-I-L-I-D, VEILID. A secure peer-to-peer network for apps that flips off the surveillance economy. How could you not love that right away? Joining us tonight, we have, and I'm going to use your handles if you want to inject your real names as well. You're welcome to. We have Dildog. Feel free to say hi.
Hey there.
Okay.
Hey. And, I exist.
We have Medusa.
Hi.
How you doing? And we have the Gibson.
Hi, everybody. Nice to see you.
And if I mispronounced any of those names, let me know. But now, you folks just gave a big presentation over at DEF CON in Vegas, introducing this new peer-to-peer network, which seems like nothing I've ever really heard before. It's very ambitious. Wikipedia describes it this way. A peer-to-peer network and application framework released by Cult of the Dead Cow, which, yes, you folks are part of that amazing organization that's existed since 1984. Described by its authors as like Tor, but for apps. We'll explain that in a moment. It is written in Rust, runs on Linux, Mac OS, Windows, Android, iOS, and in browser WASM, Valid Chat is a secure messaging application built on Valid. It borrows from both the Tor anonymizing router and the interplanetary file system to offer encrypted and anonymous peer-to-peer connection using a 256-bit public key as the only visible ID. Even details such as IP addresses are hidden. Well, let's start with where the inspiration for this came from. And I imagine the inspiration probably came from the incredible surveillance we find ourselves under on a daily basis, increasingly.
I'll go ahead and start with a little bit of the history here. It was about 4 years ago. I was talking with Metis 4 over here about the problems of social media, and you know, we had started to see the cracks in the veneer of Twitter, and we've had a long history of problems with surveillance and monitoring of Facebook, and the question came around of how do we build something better. What would be the foundation that we would need to build to make privacy more accessible to everyone? Because, you know, you've got these great privacy frameworks like Tor and some initiatives around distributed storage. And you've got, the federation type social networks like Mastodon starting to come up. But a lot of the problems that these had were around accessibility, you know, making sure that, you know, your grandma and, you know, or anybody else, the regular people out there that aren't, you know, Linux system administrators would have a hard time sort of understanding or reaching those things. So, you know, we talked about this for like a good long year, thinking about how to make something that could reach those people, and we settled on designing a privacy-oriented framework that people could build apps with, regular apps that look like any other app, except the key difference being that these apps could talk directly to each other instead of relying on a cloud run by some billionaire that's hoovering up all your personal data. You know, finding a way to use the fact that we all have supercomputers in our pockets these days. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have these $1,000 iPhones and Android devices with, and you're paying for bandwidth already. You know, you're already paid into this, you know, huge computer powerhouse that you carry around with you. Why not leverage that to build a cloud that is everyone's computer instead of some centralized thing? You know, there's naturally going to be some challenges around data provenance, like where does the data live? How do you keep it safe? How do you keep people's IP addresses safe? And how do you, give developers a choice, a better choice, about how to build applications so they don't feel the need to monetize every little thing about their users? I mean, maybe they want to sell ads. Maybe they want to do that stuff. But right now, if you have a big cloud bill to pay, you kind of have to. You can't offer free software because you got bills. You know, so let's build a better system that removes some of the sort of perverse incentives to monetize people.
You know, what strikes me is that why did it take so long for somebody to do something like this? Because this has been a problem for a while. It's getting to be more and more of a problem, obviously. But what you describe, assuming it's easy to use, and that is key, that it's easy for non-technical people to be able to get a handle on this. But it would seem like somebody would have come up with an idea like this. Or maybe it's just they didn't have the technical ability to put it together. Is that possible?
There was some prior art, you know. There's, you know, other little pieces of this. And again, you know, you've got a solution for private routing with Tor, but Tor kind of requires that you know how to set up a proxy and that you know what a proxy is. There's IPFS, but you have to set up a server someplace and you don't have to know how all that works. So really this is an accessibility thing. And, you know, there's so many technologists that build great tools, but don't focus on accessibility in the end user. Getting all of the right things together in one place, but with the only success criteria being zero configuration, make it accessible to everybody, make it work with every kind of app. You know, I want Valid in messengers and social networks, but I also want it in video games. You know, I want it, you know, in every kind of app, you know, and that's the, you know, was one of the critical design requirements of Valid, was that, you know, it would be a framework that every app could use, not just, you know, pigeonholing us as a, you know, privacy specific browser or a privacy specific framework. It's really got to provide the tools to build any kind of app. That's what's going to make it successful, I think.
Okay. Alex, I know you have something to say. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, I got a little lag here because I'm on the other side of the world, and it's a little late. But I do have a couple of things. I have a couple of questions for you, Dildog or Gibson or Medusa, in terms of how this framework works. Could you explain to our listeners how this framework, this privacy-enhancing framework on which other things can be built, would necessarily break this surveillance capitalism system that we see being employed universally throughout social media and throughout every popular app these days? How does that work with respect to Twitter or Facebook or whatever the newest idiotic thing from Facebook is called, Threads or something like that?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have everybody answer this alongside me because I think we all have different perspectives on this. But, you know, from my perspective, it's not necessarily going to be embraced by those who have a vested interest in the data economy. You're not going to, you know, rehabilitate Facebook or Twitter with this. But, you know, maybe it's time for people to build accessible alternatives to those services that don't have advertising or tracking built into them. I can tell you that, you know, I'm working on a chat app right now, and the chat app has zero cost to me. I write it, I publish it on the App Store. People, you know, it's in beta right now in test flight. My cost is zero. There is no cloud bill. There's nothing. I don't have to make a choice to monetize anything about anybody. I don't have to sell ads. It literally costs me nothing to run the infrastructure here because it's all just the users using the app their way. So anyway, that's my perspective. Anybody else want to chime in there?
I think one of the things that is really underlooked as far as a motivation for people to do things and pour their time and their energy into projects is the desire to do something that's worthwhile. Greed has kind of taken over our entire internet, our industry, beyond just keeping the lights on and, you know, taking care of your family. I mean, these paychecks are getting huge and people are used to that. And they don't feel like, you know, some, you know, people have the idea that they just need to get paid. And I think there's a way to, you know, balance that. I remember when I was invited more recently, just a few years ago, into the Cult of the Dead Cow, and how it felt to finally feel like I could maybe make a difference and do something with the platform that I was given. I wanted to get out there and hack the planet. And I hope other people feel the same way. And that's why we wanted to do this, you know, not only as individuals, but as the Cult of the Dead Cow, because I want to feel inspired. I want to feel motivated to get out there and do something that matters. And I hope that other people do too. And we're building a great community of people that all have that same ideal. And I'm really excited to see where it's going. Any thoughts from you, Gibson?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm going to kind of double down on what both of you said. I ran Hackers.Town starting in 2017. And starting that process and seeing if a community showed up for it was kind of mind-blowing to me that people actually are there. I know, for example, Rob has an account there and hangs out with us pretty regularly. One of the things I've been saying since the very beginning, two things I've been saying since the very beginning, you know, I built that place, Cargo Culting, off the work of the Cult of the Dead Cow. And I knew it when I did it, and I will freely admit to that, and anybody that asks, because I didn't see enough of that early hacker era mentality showing up in the modern age. And I may have been radicalized by political events around that time period. So, you know, I wanted to build something that was safe and allowed us to collaborate. And that happened, and people showed up for the party, and it was great. But, you know, even federated solutions like Mastodon have problems. Scrapers, ways that data can be mined off of those sites that are against the will of the people of the site or even the admins of the site. And having a distributed model like this that doesn't really have exit nodes onto the internet, so to speak, and makes it very difficult to mine that data, makes that data mining experience so expensive at the end of the day that there's no profit in it. So to me, there's two sides. As Dildog said, actually, there's three sides, because I'm throwing everything here. As Dildog said, there's very little cost, if any, to running these apps. So it reduces the need for making money on the apps for the app to survive. Secondly, it's about community for me. I want a safe place for my people to go and not feel like they're being watched every second or every day, and not even necessarily for malicious reasons. You know, I don't want them feeling like their data is being mined to be used against them or to market to them. It's not fair. It shouldn't be there. And I feel like we dropped the ball 20 years ago as a community when we didn't be louder about this. Kudos to the people in this room. I know we are all pretty loud, but you know, the as a whole, we didn't fight back enough to slow this down and kind of said, oh, that's great. You know, we've got Facebook. That's cool. I don't have to host stuff anymore. Except at the end of the day, we still did because that data was just being hoovered up. So now we get to this point. And my last third point here is that, you know, we're restoring the future that was supposed to happen is the way I look at it. We talked about this a lot, but we are in the position now where we're able to give people their own user agency back over their data construct, if you will. And I don't see a difference between that data construct that you put out on the internet and your physical or mental self that you contain within you. They're all part of you, and those rights belong to you, and we shouldn't be able to give those away at the click of an agree to EULA button. So that's why I'm here and why I think this is such a great turn of events, because we have finally some tooling that allows us to engender these values in the developer community at large.
Go ahead, Alex.
I love all three of those answers. I think they're fascinating. And the way in which you articulated the economic incentives underlying this foundation, I think, is what could really be very disruptive here. Because if you think about how Twitter works or how any of these massive platforms, it's all about this cloud computing bill that they have at the end of the month that is going to cause them essentially to be enslaved to that surveillance economy model, because they are indentured servants to AWS, or they're an indentured servant essentially to Microsoft Azure. So if you give developers an economic incentive to use this framework, namely avoidance of this massive bill every single month, the way I see this is maybe this is going to be something akin to a rebirth or a renaissance for things like free software. Remember way back in the 90s when we saw shareware coming out, and it was great because we could you could play around and you could download shareware where you there's a lot of open source things going on. There was just such a greater sense of collaboration and more communities popping up where people supported each other in these types of endeavors. And it seems to me like this might create that kind of community again. And unless I'm getting it wrong, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
We've jokingly referred to this internally as Web 1.5 instead of Web 3 or Web 2 or whatever you said. Taking it back to kind of those principles that we saw that were good about the internet back in the 90s and making them modern and setting up a way to succeed at that. And while at the same time respecting user agency.
Now, I have to ask, what has the reaction been so far since you guys introduced this?
So far, the reaction has been fantastic. We built a small community on Discord for now. And thus far, it's grown to about 1,400 people that are all working together, that are sharing different ways that they are, building and putting nodes on. Different things. I've seen nodes being put on. People are kind of trying to put them on the craziest things they can. And it's been wonderful to see just people come together. And it's not only the people that are, technically capable enough to put nodes on. We've also got a lot of people in there that are, want to make sure that they'll be able to help out with accessibility or, marketing and getting this in the right hands and making sure that it's going to be approachable and usable for everyone, not just, the people that are on this phone call or, listening to this, the people that, understand computers. We have entire generations of people that use maybe 1 to 3 websites. One of them's Facebook, they got Google, and maybe one more. But they're being tracked in every way, shape, or form, and we're kind of stuck using those websites because of them. There's a lot of people that still use Facebook because that's the only way they really can connect with, Aunt Sally or their neighbor growing up, and they can show off pictures of the kids and, share with their life with them without having to actually make a phone call. And we're all kind of stuck using Facebook too. So if we can get those folks comfortable enough to get off the only social media platform that they've ever used. If we can get our parents off of Facebook, we are free.
Wow. Kyle, go ahead.
I wanted to ask what, for some of our listeners who may not be developers and may not be working on the project, what is it like to use something that has implemented this, and or what can people expect when they do find it in different places? Is there anything different about using it with all of these different layers having increased protection? What does it look like functionally for users?
Well, currently there are no practical apps that use the framework yet. We are working on it. However, we do have a demonstration app called Veiled Chat that should be open sourced very soon. I am just working on cleaning up some of my ugly source code. But in general, you can expect that the apps that use Veiled will feel practically the same as any other app. One of the sort of primary design constraints was that it was mobile first. So we're talking Android and iOS as well as Windows, Mac, Linux, et cetera, and web apps. But for that to really work, you have to be plugging into the kinds of frameworks that mobile app developers expect. So we chose Flutter as a sort of first flagship UI platform. So Flutter apps are things like they'll look like your DoorDash app or the Instacart app. Those kinds of apps, React Native is coming along very quickly as well, support for that. So all of the sort of professional, smooth, web-oriented but mobile-first development frameworks that all these professional apps are written in, Veiled is a first-class plugin for all those things. So you won't really notice the difference. For Veiled Chat, maybe signing up is a little different experience because you're not like putting in an email and a password and then having email you to verify that you're at that email. You don't have to give VeiloChat your email. When you sign up, you put in a name you'd like to be referred to as, and it creates an invitation, which is like a little QR code or a little blob of text that you can paste to your friend, and your friend can accept your invitation by, you know, pasting that into their copy of VeiloChat. You know, the actual sort of sign-up process is going to feel a little different. Right now, Veilo does not have a concept of identity as like a one blessed way to refer to people. That's sort of a feature as well as, you know, an early development constraint. But the idea here is that you're not going to be going through a lot of the same authentication systems that you might be used to. You're not going to log in with Apple or log in with Google. You're not going to be using – they're not going to have that opportunity to use your identity as like a convenient login. That's sort of where the data collection process starts, you know, and we're trying to make sure that that isn't part of the apps that that people write with Veilid.
Fascinating. Gila, did you have something? You're muted, Gila.
Sorry, let's try that again. I am actually transmitting a question that we have been asked over Mastodon from a listener who goes by the name Adam. So here's the question. Can you explain how Veilid is different than I2P and why Veilid doesn't leverage I2P under the hood?
Wow.
Okay. Well, I'm no expert on I2P, first off. Second, there are a lot of other frameworks out there. I started working on this 4 years ago, specifically with mobile devices in mind. None of the other frameworks out there really considered the reality of switching between networks on a regular basis and having really high node churn. So a lot of these node-based systems have like a an expectation of uptime to some extent. Veilid was designed for something that might be offline and then come online on a cellular network and then get on a Wi-Fi network and then you drive past a Starbucks and you switch to another one and then you get home and you're on your private network. Having nodes that are actually truly mobile does complicate some of the underlying routing and node liveness checks and things that you have to do. Designing with that in mind, I felt was really important because that's how a lot of the sort of ad hoc nature of networks is going to be going forward. You're just not always going to have nodes that are static IPs or, you know, running on a little server in your house. You know, I looked at a lot of the sort of Web 3.0 style cryptocurrency based networks like this, and a lot of them did sort of require some kind of either a device or a you know, some kind of server that you run. You know, so they were not designing with this use case in mind. This way, you know, I got a lot of design flexibility. You know, between that and some, you know, I'd say that private routing is one of the big things we do differently, and we do pretty well. But there's a lot of other design choices we made in Veilid that did not translate from other systems. Like our distributed hash table model is very different. When you get down to it, it's faster. It has more data locality. I could go on and on about the technical reasons why I made those choices, but I wanted that creative flexibility, and I couldn't get that just embracing IPFS. Frankly, IPFS is slow. Tor also kind of slow, but the reasons why they're kind of slow for my use case anyway, kind of fade away a little bit if I can just take all the parts that are slow and optimize those down to just the parts we need. You know, so yeah, it was a performance and you know, choice, but also you got to get that core small enough that it could, you know, fit into a mobile app without any trouble. So just a lot of sort of technical design constraints.
Rob, go ahead.
I think I'd like to go back a little bit to I think what Kyle mentioned and some others, which is the user end of this and how this is not an app in itself. It's a framework for apps. I think a lot of the power of this idea is in the security. When a user, even a non-technical user, gets hold of an app that's built with this framework, it's going to be pretty much push a button and go. It's not going to require separate things, like if you were using Tor or if you were using some sort of proxy or something else, the other common privacy protecting methods out there. Could you talk a little bit about that as just sort of what it means for the end user to be able to just use something that was developed on this?
Yeah, and keeping in mind that most of our audience is non-technical. We're broadcasting in New York City, so as if you're talking to an elderly relative. If we can get them excited about this, I think that's the mission here.
I mean, ultimately, well, oh, Caitlin, go ahead.
Okay, well, somebody has to go.
Ultimately, you know, thus far, a lot of privacy-focused apps have been very just difficult and kind of a pain to use. You know, it's very difficult to convince somebody that has been using, you know, their method of remembering passwords to even switch to something like a password manager. Even though they know it's in their best interest, just the, you know, absolute overwhelmingness of it all can be enough to turn somebody off from trying it. One of the things that we really want to build in from the beginning is making sure that these apps don't feel any different. Mastodon is wonderful in the way that it connects people and the way that they are, you know, handling privacy. And I'm not here to talk any smack about Mastodon, but they also make it extremely difficult for a person to sign in on mobile. And they did not put mobile first, and that's how most of us use social media these days. They didn't make it easy to, you know, sign back in after you had made a username. It just was very off-putting for most people, and that's why it didn't get widely adopted outside of the tech communities or, you know, the generations of people that grew up with the internet. The difference with Valid is we want to create usable apps and helpful apps that don't feel any different. There is not going to be a time or a frustration cost to having that extra privacy.
Okay. Gibson, go ahead.
To speak to Rob's point, too, that's the whole point of the framework, right? Ultimately, we're providing that tool so that other developers can come in and develop apps that bake this in right from the layer zero, right? So whenever they start to build an app, they have a great idea for an app. They don't have to worry about figuring out how to make it private or secure it. They can rely on the Valid framework to do that for them. So ultimately, it puts us in a position of being able to help anybody that wants to do this, anybody that wants to move into a more private model for the data economy, if you will, it gives them the tools to do that. So at the end of the day, the ease of use for that privacy becomes much simpler for all users because they're just downloading an app from an app store, right? And the privacy is baked in because it's at the base layer of everything that's programmed for property. So ultimately, the idea is to change the entire way that your personal data's privacy is approached and make it easy for developers to do so that everybody can benefit from this in the long run.
Something else that I think might be of interest to some of our casual listeners, you all mentioned Cult of the Dead Cow, and we've talked about that quite a bit. Can we say anything, perhaps something reassuring about it's not really a cult. There are no dead cows. What does it actually mean? Because we obviously all revere this organization, but why? I guess that's what I'm looking for.
Why Cult of the Dead Cow? CDC having a very long view on the computer social revolution. Acknowledges that there's a lot of opportunity
to sort of connect with people over different kinds of media. You know, CDC's first publications were things that, you know, people would not get from Walden Books or your local bookstore. It was weird text files that you could get only from downloading from a bulletin board system, but it was homebrew publication. It was a way of reaching people with weird alternative ideas and cool stories and narrative fiction and, you know, the lyrics to Metallica songs. I mean, whatever it was, you know, we had a channel to distribute this the message of CDC. You know, over the years, we've done our best to sort of constantly, you know, we pull down the pants of Microsoft on a regular basis. You know, we got to be a thorn in the side of a lot of our different organizations with either security advisories or various hijinks at different conferences. You know, our members have gotten involved in a lot of different political movements as well. You know, CDC is not just hackers. CDC is about a worldwide artistic and scientific effort to extend people's accessibility to weird information and cool things that they should, you know, be able to build communities around. You know, the hacker community is just one, but if, you know, we're full of artists and musicians. You know, if anything, CDC is trying to be a worldwide organization, and that requires a worldwide skill set. You don't build the revolution of application privacy on the back of just some hacker privacy mindset. You have to look at it from people and the way they communicate. CDC has a fundamental understanding of how people communicate. We've leveraged it sometimes for our own gain, sometimes for entertainment, you know, sometimes just for, you know, for the heck of it. You know, we've done some pretty loud and boisterous things. People pay attention. We're leveraging that. We're trying to, you know, use that pulpit that we have to spread the word that privacy is something that everyone deserves, and it shouldn't be as hard to get as it is today.
And if I'm not mistaken, you guys have been around for 40 years now?
Yeah, some of us, yep. Longer
wow.
than others.
That's I mean, we have been too, but wow, that's simply amazing. Alex, I believe you had some question. You're muted, Alex.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, no, I'm just on a little bit of a lag here. I love the history of the CDC, and I mean, I remember revering CDC back when I was 15 years old, and was so excited to meet CDC members at the first Hope Conference back in 1994. And I think, was it the first Hope Conference or maybe the second one when the CDC revealed back orifice? That was, you know, you talk about being a thorn in the side of Microsoft. That was that the first Hope?
That was actually at DEF CON 6. Sergistic released it at DEF CON 6 in 1998. Yeah, so that's quite some time ago.
I thought it was at Hope. We were
at Hope shortly thereafter. That you probably ran into us at Hope.
Yeah, we talked about it.
Yeah, we did have a presentation.
So. Uh-huh.
Gotcha.
We've been celebrating the 25th anniversary of back orifice.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. That is amazing. But I had, you know, another point to go back to Valid for a second, if we don't mind. But I think it really does dovetail with the evolution of CDC here. The point that I'm trying to make is that the times have changed. Things are different. A lot of the original CDC members were all grown up now. Some of us are, you know, cybersecurity professionals, politicians, lawyers, poets, etc. But a lot of us have kids, right? So a lot of, you know, and here's where I think Valid could be so interesting and really find a niche area, because you think back to, God, was it last year? We're in the throes of another election cycle. We were talking about he was 8 or 9 years old then, my oldest child, but watching YouTube videos while we live in New York, but we have a little house over in Pennsylvania. I often do the radio show from there. And he was bombarded because of his IP address being in Pennsylvania, and it was the midterm elections, with political ads on kids' YouTube videos about John Fetterman. and how he was going to release criminals out in the wild and destroy the character of Pennsylvania. You know, and this really upset my son. He didn't know what the hell was going on there. And so I see perhaps these apps that could be developed on the Valid framework could be very parent-friendly or be very child-friendly in a sense, because they are anti-surveillance. You know that your child is not going to be surveilled or tracked. And just the whole idea that my child has a profile on YouTube and is being tracked and psychologically profiled from such a young age, and that data will track with him forever if he's not careful about it, is really disquieting to me. I see Valid as something that can break that cycle by not letting it even happen in the first place.
Absolutely. And it gets more sinister than that, too. Not only are they, you know, advertising things to our children, but they're also collecting our data and they're selling that off to the highest bidder. And I'm talking about various platforms here. But say you join a group, you know, a support group on Facebook about, you know, your depression or a health issue that you have. Do you think that somehow that's not going to, you know, find its way in the data economy to, you know, insurance carriers? And then someday, generations from now, that may be held against the people that you care about the most. And we're not really looking at the very sinister aspects of all of this. We just saw, you know, somebody was arrested recently due to planning to get some health care over Facebook Messenger. And that just shows that this is taking a very sinister turn. And we need to put a stop to it, not only for us, but yes, for the future generations to come.
And we're just talking about this country. Imagine in other countries where things might be even worse. This kind of a tool could be a lifesaver in many cases, I think.
Absolutely, it can. That would, you know, we talked about that extensively in the early days of this. Ultimately, the idea is to help engender that privacy of communications that we all feel like we can take for granted but doesn't exist anymore. And whether that be, you know, someone in an oppressive state or someone that's just looking to communicate quietly with someone they love, it doesn't matter, right? Those things all come into play here. Good use is good use. And I think one of the other jokes we've had internally is calling this chaotic good as a service, right? Ultimately, we want to empower people to be people.
Now, are there any safety concerns that you've discussed? We know of good people that want to use this tool. What about bad people who might want to use this tool? Is there some kind of a freedom that you might inadvertently be giving evil people to carry on with their work?
That was one of the things that, you know, Dill had brought to me from the very beginning. My history, personally, as far as any of this, the where I found myself in life these days, and everything was a few years ago, somebody stole my ex's phone and shared some pictures on the internet that I didn't want to be out there. And I got angry and I started organizing other victims of what is commonly referred to as revenge porn. But I prefer the term non-consensual image abuse. Started organizing the victims, helping change laws, and, you know, essentially without realizing I had done it, I was doing a hacktivism. And, you know, that was the first time that I was introduced into any sort of community here, cybersecurity, hacking, any of that. And, you know, when Dill first approached me, he was, you know, a little concerned about that. He said, you know, we want to make sure that we are building something that is a net good for the world. And so we have really spent a lot of time discussing the various, you know, methods that we can use to keep this safe and to make sure that this isn't going to just turn into a big old monster. And we've got some ideas to address that when we get there, though, because as of right now, it is a framework. It is something for people to build with, and, you know, it's just the code. Once we get to the part where we're actually building apps and working with developers and getting those out there, that's when we're really going to be able to show some of the unique ways that we have started to address this issue and that we plan on approaching it.
Yeah, there are you know, going to be a lot of apps using Veiled. The thing to remember is that Veiled itself is just a framework for building apps. It doesn't make an effort to somewhat, I don't know, police what apps do with the framework. That said, it has been designed with sort of data provenance in mind. The one thing that, if anything, we've decided was a net good for the world was to make it difficult to simply dragnet the data of a bunch of innocent people. There's so many opportunities for people to get mislabeled or to accidentally stumble into these sort of data dragnets that have become you know, fashionable letters to Facebook where they just dump everyone's private messages to law enforcement. You know, you don't get a pass in the law enforcement community for simply, you know, warrantlessly searching everyone's information. Certain kinds of law enforcement actions should require more care from law enforcement than they, you know, and more sensitivity to the people being searched than they get today. It is somewhat of a reckless process by which people's data is hoovered into mass surveillance. This does not mean that, you know, criminals are given a pass to operate over Veiled. Individual applications that do not adhere to, say, the App Store policies of Apple or the Google Play Store will still have their apps removed. You know, you can't just go and, you know, do whatever you want over Veiled and get away with it. You have to still follow the rules of these platforms that distribute the applications in the first place. So I don't think this makes things more difficult or any worse. You know, if people are going to do bad things today, they're going to do it over Tor. They're going to do it over other mediums. You know, the biggest, you know, non-consensual and underage, you know, pornography and, you know, image abuse, you know, the biggest offenders here are going to be the large social networks anyway. It's going to be the Facebooks. You know, they've got all this stuff. If anything, you know, they've started to tackle those issues by using technologies like Microsoft Photo DNA to scan pool, you know, scan people's uploads and, you know, look for missing and exploited children, stuff like that. You know, those are closed source technologies. Those are not accessible to every single app developer out there. And that's somewhat of a shame. You know, if Veiled helps people, demand access to libraries like that and tools. These databases, you know, if you get enough people in charge of their own content instead of just outsourcing it all to Facebook, you're going to see making those kinds of like reports and collaborative efforts to, you know, unmask, you know, people committing crimes or whatever. You're gonna have an opportunity to do that on a more personal level than simply centralizing everything and just dragnetting people who might not actually have anything to do with it.
You know, it's interesting because we talk about how people are being surveilled and monitored and watched, but I don't think people realize the extent of it. And Dildog, you mentioned Tor just a moment ago, and I believe at DEF CON, you said that the NSA runs 100 Tor exit nodes. I don't think most people realize that. What are the implications of something like that?
Well, you know, it's, you know, not, it turns out that it's not as hard as you'd think to monitor systems like that when
You have control over the way people use it from the entry point to the exit point. You know, with Valid, you're looking at millions and millions of notes. It becomes harder to monitor, you know, when you have that many nodes. The more data, the long and short is that if you keep the data in the network, it becomes a lot harder to monitor it and to spy on it. As soon as you leave the network, then, you know, you're back on the regular internet unencrypted. And, you know, so if there is no edge, you don't get anything by monitoring the edge that doesn't exist. You know, so we're trying to make sure that everything can be done in network. It will make things a lot safer for people.
Last question I have to ask. Tell us about the name.
This was my creation. It is Valid Veiled ID.
Okay.
Just a bunch of words that I just put together, uh-huh. And it works. And there has been a lot of, you know, you asked earlier what the response has been thus far, and there's been a lot of talk about our name. And that seems to be the thing that everybody is, you know, the most upset about thus far. So, hey, if
really?
We're...
I like the name. Why are people upset at the name? I mean, maybe you could
I don't know. You could
capitalize ID if you want to make it more obvious, but I don't think you need to.
People keep mispronouncing it, or they don't like the name, but we're rolling with it.
It doesn't matter.
Just say it's a framework and say, like, no, it's, you know, not an app. It doesn't have to be. It's like whiz bang. And
I didn't like the name 2600 when we started, and look what happened. So it's don't listen to them.
Right.
Okay, we're in our last minute. Contact info, ways that people can get involved, learn more. Go for it.
Everything is on veilid.com. That's spelled veilid.com. You can check out the code. There's links to the community. We talk about our ideals there. People that, you know, have questions can always join our Discord. That's also listed on there. Or they can follow us on various social media apps. If anybody wants to talk about those.
Does anybody?
Yeah, we have, they're all listed on the site. You know, we actually have Valid Networks at hackers.town, which is one of the official accounts. We have accounts on X/Twitter, Blue Sky. I'm sure I'm missing some others, because the entire social media landscape is on fire and there's too many offerings. But those are all listed on the site. If you choose to follow us there, you can also submit questions to us through any of those accounts.
And you guys, according to your site, you are not looking for investor funding. Is that correct?
We are purely a nonprofit. Small dollar amounts can be donated through the site, but we are not looking for investor funding. This is meant to stay non-capitalist and free to the world.
Awesome. Wow. I hope you can stick around for overtime at 8, all three of you or any of you. Best of luck with all this. Congratulations on starting it. I know there's a long road ahead, but what you're doing is truly amazing, and you're the right people to be doing it. So thank you.
Thank you for
thank
having
you.
Us.
You can write to us at Off the Hook, OTH@2600.com. I believe we're on next week, and if so, then tune in at 7 o'clock on WBAI. In the meantime, stay tuned to WBAI or join us over on YouTube. Follow the link on the 2600.com webpage or just go to channel 2600, and we'll continue this conversation over there. And you could even call in. We'll see you next time. Good night.